right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. In the beginning of the show, we're going to be talking with David McMahon, Raymond Santana, and Kevin Richardson, the co-director and two of the former defendants in the Central Park 5 case. And they're actually, David's a co-director of a film, The Central Park 5, which is a really stunning film and is playing in different parts of the country right now. So if you get a chance to see it, rush out to see it. All right. Don't miss it. It's a very powerful film. And in the back end of the show, we'll be listening to an excerpt from a speech by Bob Avakian on the role of the police. So stay tuned for that. But right now, let's just jump into the first segment of the show.
I saw the movie a couple of weeks ago and went into it, and I'm familiar with the case from my own, you know, what I was doing, what I was looking at, where I was living, what I was thinking back in 1989 and before that. The film that we're going to be talking about today is The Central Park Five, and I'll just read you a brief description of it. In 1989, five black and Latino teenagers from Harlem, from the east end of Harlem,
That's right.
And the north end of the Central Park, were arrested and later convicted of brutally beating and raping a white woman in New York City's Central Park. You know, look, this is one of the most outrageous, racist, and just vitriolic campaign against youth of color that this country has seen in quite some time. It mobilized all kinds of forces, loudmouth idiots, racist boobs like Donald Trump, Ed Koch, all of these people lined up to put out what they were trying to do, the demonization, not only of these youth, but of an entire generation of black and Latino youth. And actually, and by extension, black and Latino people. Well, the Central Park Five each spent between 6 and 13 years in prison before a shocking confession from a serial rapist and DNA evidence proved their innocence. Set against the backdrop of a decaying city beset by violence and racial tension, the Central Park Five tells the story of how five lives were upended by the rush to judgment by police, a sensationalist media, and a devastating miscarriage of justice. And joining us now to talk about this is co-director, co-writer, co-producer, David McMahon. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Sure. And we're also very pleased to and privileged to have two of the defendants, former defendants, present in studio with us. To my right is Kevin Richardson. How are
Hello.
You, Kevin?
Thank you.
Sure. And Kevin, you're going to have to get right up on the mic.
Yes.
And then sitting over here acting like he just like so used to, you know, this is because I saw the movie and I know you were a DJ and you wanted to be an MC. Sitting to my left is Raymond Santana. Raymond, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having us.
Sure. Well, let's jump into this and we have as much time as we want right now. So let's make sure that people get the full story of all this. David, what compelled you to make this film? This is 20 years after the original trials, 10 years after the verdicts were vacated. What compelled you guys to make the film? And I should say you're making it with Ken Burns and Sarah Burns. So what compelled you folks to make this film now?
Well, my co-director, Sarah Burns, as an undergraduate a decade ago, became interested in the story. She wondered about the media representations of the five in 1989, right after the incident happened. And so I believe she first met Raymond and Kevin, and they agreed to talk to her about it. She became so interested in it that after she finished school, she wrote a book about it, and she talked to all five at length. And I think she felt, and Ken and myself felt the same way while she was writing the book, that we had to make a film about this, namely because we wanted to understand the mystery of how it was this happened. We knew they were innocent, and we wondered what could have led to this taking place. But also we thought, what an opportunity to hear from the five directly. You know, Sarah had, I think, over the years of writing the book, gained the trust of the five enough where they were willing to talk to us on camera. And the guy should talk about that. But it was just too good an opportunity to hear from them and get their perspective on the story.
Well, you know, Ken Burns said that this tragedy reminds us of how much we struggle to come to terms with America's original sin, which is race. One need only to look at the history books to understand that. Unfortunately, the Central Park Five are not unique in American history. What role did that play? What part did that play in your thinking about, for yourself, thinking about making this film?
Oh, it played a tremendous role. I mean, if you look at the way that the story was covered in 1989, you can see echoes of that going all the way back through the 20th century. You see the language that was used in the reporting on lynchings in the early 20th century in the South. You see the way that the boys who were accused in the Scottsboro case, the way that they were described, this animal language, this dehumanizing language. You see it in the case of Emmett Till, and you see it again in the story of the Central Park Five. And so it is a continuum, and all of that suggests that we need to be vigilant because the same thing could actually happen again, because the same prejudices and suspicions that led people to write those things and to feel that hatred 100 years ago still exists today. And we can see that in the Trayvon Martin case. We can see it in the policies of the NYPD and their stop and frisk policy. And so we need to keep talking about this, and we need to be vigilant.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I do want to explore those questions you just raised about what the impact of this had on today and how it's playing out today in relation to both Trayvon Martin. In many ways, it's very similar to that and stop and frisk. And I think we'll get into that in a little bit later. But now let's talk with you guys. Raymond, what did you think? I mean, this has been for people who haven't seen the film, your life was so dramatically changed. I mean, and we'll talk about a lot of that later. But what did you think about the idea of making a film? Because here you were, and I'm going to ask Kevin, I'm going to ask you the same thing. So be thinking about it. What did you think? What was your reaction? Because it could have been like, what the hell are you talking about, man? I have just been dragged through the mud for most of my life. I lost a lot of my life. You think I'm going to come out here and talk to you? Mm-hmm. What were you thinking?
Well, back then, like Dave said, back in 1989, we were 14 and 15 years old, and our voice was stolen in the process throughout this whole case. And so what happened was that, when we was approached by Sarah, she just wanted to write a paper. And so we was fine with that because she worked at our attorney's office. And then later on, when she came back and she, proposed to do a book, it became more of like, all right, now we get a chance where we can finally tell our story, where people can, read these lines and sympathize with us, as being kids, not that we were a wolf pack and we was urban terrorists and rapists, And so that became like the focal point for us. It was a point for us. It also became part of a healing process, to have these labels for all these years and then finally, to get exonerated and not receive the proper recognition of the exoneration, where it was on page 15 or page 20. And so this was our time now to come forward as grown men. And, we have kids now. Some of us have kids. And so it's all about taking responsibility, And so this became our duty. Our duty was to give back, and that's through our story.
Mm-hmm. Kevin, what about you?
Piggybacking off of Raymond a little bit. back then we didn't have a voice, and it was so negative. The media frenzy was overwhelming to us, so we was kind of shy to let our voices be heard. But when the truth came out, we were so overwhelmed to let our voice be heard as grown men and get our point across, because people need to see us as grown men and see what we've been through. So we wanted to share our story. So we was willing to, whatever Sarah was ready to do, we was ready.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today about the movie Central Park Five, and we're talking with the co-director, co-producer, co-writer, David McMahon, along with Sarah Burns and Ken Burns, and we're talking with two of the former defendants, Kevin Richardson and Raymond Santana. One thing, I spent some time this summer. I went down into to Sanford, Florida, where Trayvon Martin was killed, and I was in New York. I was in the Bronx Projects up in the West Bronx, where hip-hop first started, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so the legend goes. And out in different parts of Brooklyn, mainly in Brownsville. And actually, seeing the kinds of things that happened there, I was taking out, a campaign. I was I'm a revolutionary. I was bringing out revolution to people in these neighborhoods. And one of the things we were talking about was something that Bob Avakian had made a statement where he talked about this system has condemned generations of youth, especially here and around the world, but especially here, black and brown youth, has condemned them before they're even born to a life of poverty, misery, oblivion, and frankly, jail and everything else. How does that ring with you? When you hear somebody talk about it, do you think that's true? What do you think about that in terms of how this system has condemned entire generations of youth to a life of misery and oblivion before they're even born?
You hit it right on the head. I think that the industrial prison complex, is a $1 billion industry, and for it to run, it has to have, people have to go to prison. And so, I think that it's become a point now where they start, conditioning the youth. If in Brownsville, they have a spot, a detention center, and it looks like a small prison right in the middle of the city. And it's like, wow, if a kid sees this constantly, then it becomes, he gets adapted to it, and it becomes nothing, it becomes easy for him to go to prison, you know, because now his you know, Bloomberg is taken out to schools, and so his options become limited. And so he starts to, you know, indulge in, you know, petty stuff, and it starts to build. And I think it's all part of the process so that you can build to, you can have an easy, smooth transition for him to go to adult prison, you know, to keep feeding the system, you know. You know, it's up to us as a people to come forward and hold our politicians accountable, hold our police department accountable, our mayors, you know, because they're stealing our children at an alarming rate. And we're so busy, you know, with our jobs and trying to do what we have to do in life that we're not even seeing what's going on to the kids in our streets, you know. And it's so sad. It's horrible.
How do you feel about that, Kevin?
Yeah, it's so sad because that's all the kids, that's all they know in the streets. You know, we don't have many outlets for them. Instead of schools, they're building more jails. So we need to just bring awareness to people so they won't wind up like we did, and bring awareness to people so they won't be naive to situations that's going on.
You know, one thing that's really, to me, is really, really just indicative of what was happening is that you guys were not, you know, everything that they portrayed you, and we'll talk about the role of the media soon, but everything that they portrayed you as, you guys were the exact opposite of. I mean, I have to tell you, and David, in your film, you know, there's a sweetness that you capture in all you guys. I know, like, you guys all big and like, going, yeah. But here's the point, you know. When you were kids, you were sweet. You were kids. You know, you were 14 years old, and you could see that. You could see you were knuckleheads who were like, would, you know, wanted to do music, wanted to hang out, wanted to do this, that. You were going out with your friends for a night of just fun. And yet, that time you stepped out of your door was the last time your life was what it was. It changed completely. And so no matter what you did, you didn't do anything to put yourself there. You know, you think about that and what that means. Well, let's talk about this. Your lives changed completely on that one night, April 19th, 1989.
Yeah, I mean, I was a kid. I was 14 years old. You know, I loved to listen to music. You know, I was into a little bit of fashion. I loved to sketch. You know, I loved to draw. That was one of my biggest passions. And all that was snatched from me. You know, prison, you know, being 14 and having to go through the system, it drains you. And what happened was those loves that I had, they weren't there anymore. They was replaced now with prison life, having to grow up overnight, you know, and being in dangerous situations. You know, it changes your whole life drastically. And some of them things I can't reclaim. I can't get them back. I lost them, you know. And that's just one part. You know, there's another part where, you know, my dad, you know, he never got a chance to, you know, to pass down his values to me and his morals because I was snatched away, you know, and so I never got a chance to have those conversations with him. You know, how do you know what? Where do I take a girl on the first date, or you know what school should I pick, you know, or just how do I fill out the job application? All that stuff was gone in the blink of an eye, and it was replaced with aggression and watching my back and eating my food in less than 5 seconds.
Mm-hmm. Kevin,
yeah. I was 14 as well. I was heavily into music. I was a big influence with the hip hop scene. I used to, you know, break dance and, you know, the 80s type of thing. Let my age know a little bit.
Yeah, but, yeah, tell me about it. Yeah, yeah, the 80s.
But, you know, we lost our youth and we didn't know how to get that back because when we came out of prison, we was 23 years old, but we still was stuck.
Right.
But we didn't have a youth. We didn't know how to feel to go to the prom. We didn't know how to just do regular things that a 14, 15-year-old kid would do. And it was a long process. And actually, we're still dealing with it, being 38 years old.
David. Yeah, you look like you want to say something, so
yeah,
jump
no,
in.
I'd just like to go back to your mention of a sense of sweetness about them. And I think that it's so tragic that in 1989, that the media did not go and do their homework and try to figure out what types of homes these guys came from. Because I felt the same way immediately after interviewing them for the film. And you hear about, you know, the guys talk about not wanting to lie to their parents or that they had to get home for a curfew. Or Raymond's father wants Raymond not in the corner but in the park. I mean, these were families that cared about these kids, and that's not the way that it was represented in the papers, and that's really unfortunate because people needed to know that. It would have at least struck a little bit of balance in the favor of the guys, but the media wasn't interested in that. They were racing to convict these guys on the pages of the papers. They were racing to sell papers because they were competing with each other. They were racing to put the most sensational headlines above the fold there that they could. And lost in that was any accuracy about what the home lives of these guys were like.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today about the movie Central Park Five, and we're talking with the co-director, co-producer, co-writer, David McMahon, along with Sarah Burns and Ken Burns, and we're talking with two of the former defendants, Kevin Richardson and Raymond Santana. Now, here's something to think about, though, David, too, because there's a question here that comes up. You know, you think about this, what the context of this case was. I mean, this was a horrifying thing, and it had a lot to do with a whole program that from the highest levels of the government in this country was actually being enforced. It was rolling out in a big way. You know, you think about that. You had, and in New York alone, you had that, you know, racist nut Bernhard Goetz. Mm-hmm. And then, the day after your trial opened, you had Yusef Hawkins shot down. And look at the way the media portrayed that then. You know, they portrayed those, they said, white teenagers. They talked about, you know, this white whatever was going on, gang, even saying white teen gang members. But it was like, it was, and then Koch got up there and called it a tragic accident or a tragic murder or a tragic shooting, something like that. But all of this, that was prevented in tragedy and all this other stuff. And yet, the Central Park Five were demonized, dehumanized, and presented as the worst possible animals to roam the planet. You know, and you were kids. You were damn kids. You know, and think about how that plays out. And that plays out, look, it plays out all the way through. I mean, even growing up. I mean, it's still, I bet you anything that you guys, you know, just, I know it would be for me. You walk down the street now, and you think if you're in Harlem, if you're in, you know, any place in New York, anywhere you're at, you walk down the street, and you know, I bet you anything, you're thinking, you see a cop, you're thinking, I could be picked up.
That's right. That's right.
Go ahead.
You know, even at jobs, you know, when we apply for jobs, and now we work, and you have that initial, you know, that somebody looks at you and you say, wait a minute, did he just recognize who I am? You know, and so automatically you become kind of leery and fearful that you might lose your job. You know, and you know, for me, I was no longer Raymond Santana, my childhood friend, Raymond Santana, my neighbor. It became Raymond Santana from the Central Park Five. You know, and that's a label that we felt was always going to stay with us no matter what. And so, you know, we came into terms with it, and we tried to turn it into something more of a positive, because it had such a, you know, negative aspect to it back in 1989. It was, you know.
And Kevin, you in some ways were it seemed a little bit the quietest, the kind of into home. You were very close to your family.
Yes.
You know, and yet you were charged and you were convicted with the most serious crime.
Yes.
Attempted murder. I mean, what were you thinking during that whole process?
First of all, people that knew me, and when they seen it, they'd be like, no, not Kevin. First of all, I was raised by my mother and four other sisters, you know, so I knew morals, you know, and just to be charged with that, it was a lot just for an adult. So just imagine a kid, and just to go through everything, it felt like a ongoing nightmare every day.
Now, David, one of the things when we were talking about context and all this stuff, there's also this point of the way that this was carried out. One of the things, and I'll ask you about this a little bit later too, but one of the things that really, really gnawed at me as I watched the film and then did investigation and reading back on some of the things, including some of the things that the paper I write for was covering at the time. You look at this and there's really this scene of it didn't matter whether it was Raymond or Kevin or Yusef or Corey or anyone. You know, it didn't matter. You know, it just didn't matter. It didn't. Well, what mattered? They had a case to manufacture, and guilt or innocence of the particular individuals didn't matter. And I read something recently that there was actually sort of like a pogromish atmosphere going on around the Schomburg Plaza the night of these arrests and for a couple days afterwards. Where they? Can you talk about that at all?
Well, you know, I'd like to talk a little about context, too. I think you're exactly right. Context is really important. This is the end of a decade that was marked by heightened racial tension. There was a mayor who was not too good at bringing communities together. There were a lot of incidents that made people angry or frightened. You mentioned a couple of them. There was Howard Beach. There was Bensonhurst. There was Bernhard Goetz. We touch a little bit on those. And so by the end of the 80s, when these cops bring in this group of teenagers who are in the park that night, and question them, and they decide that they can get them for the Central Park jogger rape and get confessions from them. When they come out of that, they're celebrating a huge victory. They have something to show the people of New York, or at least a certain portion of the people in New York that they're doing something to protect everyone and keep them safe. So that's really important. And they fed a story to a news media that was ready to take it without really questioning whether the narrative was accurate or not. And they were ready to rush out and share it with the people. And so it was sort of celebrated as a victory. And so all that context is important. But I think even more important really is that weeks later when the DNA evidence comes back and it's not a match and they're looking at the video confessions and they're looking at all the evidence or lack thereof, that those people down on the ground working on this case should have said, we don't have anything here. We need to go back, walk this back and come up with a new theory. So there's both the context of the 80s, but there's also the people who were working on this who really failed to do their jobs. And that's just a question of morals or of incompetence or whatever it is. But any prosecutor looking at that evidence should have said, we don't have anything here. Let's start over and come up with a new theory. And they didn't do that.
Actually, you know what's most disturbing for me is the prosecutor actually knew that they did have something there. They actually had conclusive evidence that none of the Central Park Five, none of the defendants could have possibly raped this woman. They had that and they knew it. You know, and what that says about the point about it, it didn't matter who they had up there, as long as they were youth of color, as long as they could contribute to this overall program they had, they were going to manufacture the case. They even, I read recently where Mateus Reyes, I guess, who actually bumped into Corey in prison, yeah, and then confessed to the crime. And the cops actually apparently had bumped into him in the park, covered in blood, and they let him go because it didn't matter. Guilt or innocence of any individual did not matter. You know, and you think about this. Another part of this context I think is really important to consider is it's also contextualized by the 60s and the early 70s, where you had massive rebellions, where actually a lot of people were refusing to take this. The police were not able to keep order in society at that time. And there was a certain amount of counterinsurgency that they launched with the war on drugs became a huge thing at that time. You know, and began the quadrupling of the prison population, 2.4 million people in prison, most of them black and brown youth, or black and brown people, and a lot of them youth. You know, you think about that and what the role that this case played in that whole development. It's really, to me, it gets you so damn angry. Go ahead.
And it is a turning point in New York City. It's the height, the homicides have reached an all-time height. And, you know, Mayor Koch loses his job shortly after to Dinkins, who people suspected would have a better chance to bring the city together. But ultimately, we end up with a Law and Order guy in Rudy Giuliani, and he transforms the way law enforcement does business there, and he whitewashes the city and makes it look more clean and deals with quality of life crimes. And I think you can look back at the Central Park jogger case and also Yousef Hawkins as the end of a decade where people had at least had it with the level of crime, but these guys were scapegoated. This wasn't they weren't actually guilty of this crime, and so it has this interesting place in history in that it's so infamous and that it may have led to some changes, and yet there was no concern even really in 2002 when they were found to be innocent about telling that story as loudly as they wanted to tell the story in 1989. Mm-hmm.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today about the movie Central Park Five, and we're talking with the co-director, co-producer, co-writer, David McMahon, along with Sarah Burns and Ken Burns, and we're talking with two of the former defendants, Kevin Richardson and Raymond Santana. You know, it's interesting because the point about even with the point of crime, I mean, look, at a certain point in the early 1980s, this point of they had the war on they had the war on poor people. They talked about the war on drugs, and with that war on drugs, it unleashed all kinds of things. And they went and they warred on poor people, and they portrayed. Look, I remember. I mean, from beginning with the sympathetic view of Bernhard Goetz that was promoted. You know, who basically saw some black youth playing around on the subway and decided he could shoot them. You know, and what happened? Yeah, he got a jail sentence, whatever. You know, but mainly, the ethos in society was, well, he had to protect himself. He's a fine, upstanding citizen, and he was being threatened, you know? And this is the kind of thing that happens day in and day out. I'll tell you, when I was in New York in the summertime, it was one of those times where it's like, you know, that rain in New York where it's like really hot, and then suddenly it rains in the middle of the day, and a big, you know, basketball-sized drops are coming down and just plopping everywhere, right? And it was so hot. And I went to 125th Street to the A train, and I'm watching, and these kids, there's about 40 kids on the platform. And I was thinking about this when I was reading about the film, and when I saw the film, I was reading about you guys. 40 kids on the platform, and they're playing. They got their boxes, and I hadn't seen anybody carrying a box for a long time. Okay? But they had their boxes going. They were just having all kinds of fun. They were speaking there was about 5 different accents there, you know, Caribbean, African, you know, the South, the Bronx, whatever, you know, all this was there. And all of a sudden, I'm walking down the steps, getting a little closer, and then these cops come charging past me, and they run in, and they bust heads, and they start beating people. They start throwing boxes against the wall. They're doing all the stuff. They grab one guy, and they're back. They're pulling him away, and nobody can find out. Nobody knows why. And this kid comes up to me, and he's in tears, and they were tears of rage, but also a certain amount of, like you guys were talking about, innocence being robbed from you, you know, and you being told that you're not a person, you don't count. And he said, "We wanted to go to the beach. That's all we wanted to do. We wanted to have fun. Did they do this to us because we wanted to go to the beach, or did they do this to us because we're black and we wanted to go to the beach?" You know, and the answer was sitting there like a big fat cloud over us. You know, and you think about that and how much that's tied up into what happened to you guys. You know, like let me give people a sense of, you know, what happened to you the night you were arrested, because I think it's important for people to get that sense of what happened the night you were arrested. And a lot of people will even say, you know, there's a lot of knuckleheads out there who will say, "Well, look, you know, they confessed, they must have done something wrong." And that's what people said at the time, you know, and you'd see it all the time. People say, "Well, they got the police had them for 2 days and they were pretty thorough in their questioning and they confessed, so they must be guilty or something." Let's talk about what happened to you when you were brought into, 14 years old, brought into the police station. Kevin?
You know, we went into the police station. First of all, we were scared to death because we were surrounded by, we were quite frail at the time. Not like we look now. So, no.
These guys are all like, you know, those comics books with the big bulging muscles.
And that's the pressure of these detectives. They're all 6 feet tall. And just a lot of pressure around us in the precinct for over 15 to 24 hours. They used tactics where our parents was first there, then they wasn't. For instance, my mother, you know, she struggled with diabetes, high blood pressure, so she couldn't stay around that long. And they took her out. And then my sister Angela came there. And my sister Angela at the time, she's 9 years older than me. She was 21 at the time, but she was young herself. They kept, you know, saying, "You're going to go home. You'll be okay," you know. And as my mother would leave and my sister would come, that time frame, no parent was there, you know. And that's when the pressure goes on. So they was using tactics back and forth like a straight out of a Law and Order or something. And it was... people wouldn't really understand until they was really into that predicament. And it's easy to say, "Oh, they confessed." But what went on beyond that was interrogation and just being abusive. It's a lot going on.
Let's be clear. You guys were kept awake for 48 hours. You were yelled at. A couple people were slapped.
Yeah.
It was a threat of you know, even greater danger to you if you didn't go along with what they were saying. You know, the threat of possibly you're going to carry the whole thing, all the weight of everything. And I mean, it was torture when you think about what happened there. What was, you know?
No, definitely. It definitely was. You know, it's, and this is something that, you know, when people pose that question, you know, how can you confess to something that you didn't do? And I say, look, you know, if you watch the film, even the juror, he couldn't, you know, he cracked under pressure. And that was, what, 10 days of pressure, you know what? And he just wanted to go home. And I tell people, I say, look, you got to understand first the facts. The facts were that we were 14, 15 years old. We were kids. We were young. We were naive. We didn't know the system. And so now you put us in a room, and our parents is there. But in my case, you know, they took my grandmother out. And so when they pulled her out in the hallway is when they start to work. And they start off, you know, passive. "We just want to know what happened. Tell us what happened." And then as the questioning goes along, it becomes more aggressive, you know, and more anger and more hostility. And so, you know, at that point, because you're 14, you start to feel like you're all alone. You don't know what to do. You know, this is real pressure now. This isn't, you know, I got a test and I got to study for it. This is serious. And so, and you know, people have to also see that these are seasoned detectives. These were guys, you know, who've been on the force over 20 years. You know, this is the elite of the police department, the Homicide North Detective Squad. And so even that, these are detectives that deal with homicides. And here you have them talking to 14-year-old kids. And it's surprising, you know, when I look back that we even lasted, you know, over 20 hours. You know, that we should have cracked, you know, sooner than that. But they'll get on the stand and they'll say, all we did was ask Raymond what happened. You know, and you know that's a lie because it took you, you know, 15 to 20 hours to get a statement from me. And so when you look at the whole scenario, you know, you also have to, you know, bring in the fact that, you know, no food, no drink, no water, no sleeping, you know. This is, like you said, this is straight torture. This is straight torture. How can a 14-year-old kid survive this? I mean, it's surprising we even lasted that long.
Yeah, exactly. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today about the movie Central Park 5, and we're talking with the co-director, co-producer, co-writer, David McMahon, along with Sarah Burns and Ken Burns, and we're talking with two of the former defendants, Kevin Richardson and Raymond Santana. David, was there anything in this, as you're making this film, was there anything in this that really shocked you, that you discovered that really shocked you, that kind of gave you one of those kicks in the gut?
Well, sure, there are plenty of things like that. I think that in making the film, we wanted to understand how it was that five teenagers could be made to confess for a crime they didn't commit. You know, we knew Reyes was the perpetrator. He had confessed in 2002. And so I think it was shocking to discover how frequently false confessions take place. And you can't have false confessions without coercion. You know, there are such things as voluntary false confessions where someone comes in off the street and says, you know, I am responsible for that crime. And you go, okay, you know, and those are often about getting attention, and that comes from a totally different sort of place. But you can't have innocent people come in and then 30 hours later confess to a crime without coercion. So these were absolutely coerced. So our process of understanding how this happened was about understanding not only how false confessions happen, but how they're perceived. And so a confession is a really damning thing. I mean, there was no evidence in this case. There was no blood on the clothes. There was no understanding of where the crime took place. There were plenty of contradictions in the statements the teenagers gave. But yet a jury had no trouble convicting them. Well, the only trouble they did have was that the one guy in the film who served on the jury, Ron Gold, was that he did sense that there were these contradictions. But when he got to the deliberations, he was surprised on the first day to learn that all other 11 members of the jury were ready to move to convict right away. And he said, wait a minute, but he said it happened here, and he said it happened there, and none of it adds up. But they were basically like, but they said they did it. And so people are so prepared to believe false confessions. And the Innocence Project, which does such great work of getting people out of prison for crimes they didn't commit, they only take cases where there is DNA evidence. And they find that in 25% of the cases that they do take, there is a false confession as an element of it. And so we have a real problem with false confessions. And one thing that we can do to solve this is to videotape interrogations from the moment they begin, not 14, 15, 30 hours after, where the cops have or the detectives have worked the suspects over, developed a narrative, basically scripted it, and then turned them over, like they did in the case of these five, to the prosecutors for a video statement that is basically a rehearsal or the main event for what the rehearsal they just went through. But right from the first question, then they could knock it on the stand and say, all we did was ask Kevin, then what happened? We would be able to see how this the mechanics of all this, and it would protect cops from stepping out of bounds and using techniques that are illegal, and it would protect suspects from giving false confessions.
Well, tell me this. You know, one of the things that really grabbed me about it is, again, and look, I'm, you know, from everything I've covered, from all the things that I've learned in my life, from my own experience, I've seen manufactured frame-ups, basically. I've seen that, you know. But when it was so clear, I mean, what you brought out in the film and then the other stuff that was even what you're, you know, and it's very easy for us to fall into there was no DNA. But there, again, there was. And there was evidence, clear evidence that these guys had nothing to do with the rape, you know?
And at that point, the prosecutors, you know, when they could have walked that back and started with a new theory, they just said, well, there's a guy who got away. And the only problem with that, of course, is that there's no mention of any other guy in their confessions. And so at that point, they also should have said, you know, they don't know who that other guy is. Therefore, they were not working in conjunction with the other guy. We have the wrong people here. But they didn't do that.
And plus, the other thing is that you guys all contradicted one another. I mean, I there's a scene in the film, Raymond, where you're talking about, oh, yeah, well, Kevin's saying, I did that?
I'll tell you what, I'm going to say Kevin did this, but you guys are saying different things. And all five of you are saying different things. Mm. And there's all kinds of contradictions and stuff. And it wasn't like the DA didn't know this. You know?
Well, I mean, I didn't know Kevin back then. And I didn't know Antron. I didn't know Yusuf. I didn't know Corey. And so that's why it became easy, you know, for him to feed me those facts, because I didn't know him. I didn't know any of those guys. So you're just giving me a name, I'll just put it in. You know, and that's what it was, you know. Just like in my statement, I talked about Steve Lopez hits Patricia Molly with the brick. That came from the detective. You know, he fed me that information. So, it's and then even with the scene of the crime, the reservoir, that's why I placed it, because I didn't know where it was at. So I just said, well, it took place at the reservoir. And they knew that I was telling a lie. They knew, because they know that they didn't find it in the reservoir.
People just had to use a little logic, or didn't want to use it, because it's plain to see when you see the film, it doesn't make sense what everybody's saying. We don't know what the female's wearing. We don't know the location. Even us as kids, we didn't even speak like that about the reservoir. We didn't know about that. So when you see the film, it's very evident what happened. Yeah.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today about the movie Central Park Five, and we're talking with the co-director, co-producer, co-writer, David McMahon, along with Sarah Burns and Ken Burns, and we're talking with two of the former defendants, Kevin Richardson and Raymond Santana. Well, let's move into this, because there was also this atmosphere that was out there, which I think is extremely important. It's very interesting because, you know, this was a case, if any case ever cried out for a massive kind of movement. The comparison with the Scottsboro Boys is well taken. But also part of what happened in the Scottsboro Boys is something that didn't happen with this. Scottsboro Boys became a nationwide movement. There was a lot of people that got behind this. You guys were hung out to dry. You know, that's the basic. You were railroaded into prison with nary a peep from most people. The heavy-hitting lawyers were not there. I mean, Bill Kunstler came into his, much to his credit, at the sentencing of Yusuf and then the appeal, and it broke his heart. You know, that other people wouldn't come in. The Center for Constitutional Rights refused to take up the case. There was not particularly, and this is something that they're still fighting with, white people and white liberals and the left and the middle class were not out in the streets. You know, and it was this thing that just sat there, and this was all fed by this media frenzy that you've talked about. Pete Hamill, who described you in the most hard-hitting, graphic terms as like these animals that come roaming out of the ghetto full of crack and da-da-da-da-da, and they're searching and hunting for prey. You know, and this is the kind of thing where you get, or even Bob Herbert, the liberal, you know, who made fun of you and ridiculed you and did all this stuff. And then, you know, conveniently now, 20 years later, he says, you know, really, other people were to blame, not me, you know.
Yeah, and he's not even saying that. I mean, one of the criticisms we get about the film is, where are the police and prosecutors? We say up front that they didn't want to talk to us. Where are the members of the media who use such savage language? You know, they also did not want to talk to us, the two you mentioned. We, of course, reached out to them for interviews. We talked to the jogger. You know, she wasn't interested in participating. We asked Donald Trump. We asked everybody who we could think of who had any participation in this to come talk to us. And who you see in the film are those who were willing to give their sides of the story. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and you're right that these guys can talk better about who came to their support and who didn't. But as Bill Kunstler said to Yusuf before he defended him, the Son of God could not have gotten you off on this. There was way too much momentum towards your convictions before you ever even got to court.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think there was also a point also when we was going through this process that we thought that people were going to step up, that we figured, you know, people are going to see the inconsistencies in the statement, you know, besides the DNA not matching. People are going to see that because we feel, you know, we young, we kids, but, you know, we're just looking for the extended family to just come out and support, you know, from our communities. And, you know, there were several people who, you know, who did. Bob Slay, who, you know, is a well-known a person in New York on radio. He came, you know, he always spoke about us. Along with Braff, who we spoke about this morning, you know, was very supportive in our case. But as a whole, you know, all the people we thought who would have came never showed up. Mm-hmm. You know, and like you said, as a result, we was hung out to dry.
And, there were papers that were not mainstream, like the Amsterdam News, which is a community paper in Harlem, that were asking more questions than, say, New York Post and the Daily News and the major tabloids. But those papers have such wider readership, they really drown out everything else. I mean, it's hard to compete with those headlines and the pictures and the graphic language. And it was also sensational that there wasn't really any room for smaller papers that have weekly runs or small circulation to have a voice in the conversation. And people seem so ready to receive all that sort of harsh verdict on what had happened. You know, it supported all their thoughts about the 80s and the violence and their fears of people of color, that there wasn't really any room for the question asking that should go on. And so it wasn't just the police and prosecutors, but there were other institutions, the media, that really failed these guys. They're supposed to safeguard and protect them, but that didn't happen. And it's because of the climate that was created by all the elements you've been talking about.
Yeah, and think about this. I have two more questions, so we're going to have to squeeze this in. I think we have about maybe 5 more minutes, maybe 7 more minutes. And just to round it out, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with David McMahon, the co-producer, co-director, co-writer of Central Park 5, and two of the former defendants, Raymond Santana and Kevin Richardson. Now, tell me this. Let's talk again about the toll of this, because this is a hallmark spot in society. This is a place where, you know, things, it happened right at this point, right at the midpoint, and really ratcheted up. Even though people were, you know, you guys were eventually, you know, they don't even say that, well, you were found innocent. They vacated. They didn't exonerate you. They vacated the conviction, you know, and you still had the cops going, well, they did something and I know they were involved in it. Or that idiot DA who now has gone on to what her true career was, making up stories in novels, right? And think about it, because she was well practiced at that, you know, but all of these people, you know, there was a whole scene that was set, and there was a toll that this really took, even including in the whole pipeline to prison that develops. I mean, think about, we talk about that today, and we don't connect it up with what that's built on. And Raymond, for you, for instance, you know, I was thinking about this. I was in tears when you were talking about when you got out, you know, and you looked for a job. Let's talk about that. What happened to you when you got out and you started looking for work, and what was going on with you, and then what happened to you?
Well, you know, when I came home, I thought, you know, I can finally get a new start on life, and I could put one foot in front of the other and move forward with my life, and it was like a new beginning. And so what happened was, you know, I had this PO who was constantly on my back, you know, he told me I had to get a job or I was going to send me back to prison. And so I filled out numerous applications, and nobody would hire me. And I became very frustrated, you know, and I was like, you know, I didn't understand why. You know, here I was trying to do something right, and nobody was giving me a chance. And then also, you know, we had to register as sex offenders. We had to attend sex offender classes. And it was at that point that, you know, I reached a point that I just broke down. And I said, you know, nobody's going to hire me because, you know, I have this sex offense on my, you know, on my jacket. And then even if I get past that, I have to explain that I'm part of the Central Park jogger case. And so because of that, you know, I that was my breaking point. And I didn't know what to do. There was no transitional programs to help me get back into society and function. And so as a result, you know, we was given a social death. And I wound up returning back to prison because I started selling drugs as a means of just trying to survive, you know, because I thought I had no other outlet, no other option. And so that's what happened. And I wound up going back to jail and serving, you know, a 3.5 to 7 year sentence. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And which was actually greater than you would have served because you had a previous conviction.
Yes, I was sentenced as a predicate felon.
You know, this is something that even one of their pundits, this guy named Lutvak, actually just declared once that for kids in the ghetto, dealing drugs and crime are rational choices. You know, and that's exactly what you're laying out in that whole pipeline to prison. Now, Kevin, you managed to escape that, but you had your own. I mean, I was also very moved by the post office story, you know, trying to get a job in the post office, which, you know, frankly, the post office has its own problems. But, you might be lucky you didn't get a job there, but go ahead.
Yeah, I escaped it very thinly. I was still struggling. I was working little odds and end jobs just trying to make do. But what happened with the post office, I went there for an interview. I was qualified. They looked at my resume. They said, okay. And then they asked me a question. Have I ever been incarcerated? So I said, yeah. They took a few minutes, and they told me, well, we can't hire you. And that right there was so demoralizing for me because I thought I was finally able to move forward with also having the label of a sex offender on my back. Once again, the future determined before you're even born. Now, David, I have to ask you this last question. You guys have come under attack from the very same police who aren't out there saying, oh, we did wrong, we made a mistake, we're checking it all out. Instead, they've attacked you. They've actually issued a subpoena for a lot of the material you gathered in making the film. Let's talk about that real quick.
Yeah, in September, the city of New York served us with a subpoena for all the notes and outtakes that we'd gathered for the film. I think they're hoping to be able to comb through the tapes and find something that the five say that contradict something they said in the past. It's really a fishing expedition, and we're not going to turn any of that over. We've filed a motion to quash the subpoena, and we'll let a judge tell us that we have to give them the notes and outtakes. This is really just about stalling and delaying a civil suit that has been on the back burner for them for a decade, keeping these guys blowing in the wind.
And I'd say even more, it's also about, you know what, people like you, the kind of films you make, the kind of digging into the corners that you're not supposed to dig into. It's certainly mean that putting the fear of God into you, you know, and that's something that we cannot allow to happen.
All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've just been talking with David McMahon, the co-director, co-writer, co-producer of Central Park 5, and we've been joined by Raymond Santana and Kevin Richardson, two of the former defendants in that case. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be listening to a section of a speech by Bob Avakian, and the topic is the role of the police. So stay tuned.
The dark brown shades of my skin only add color to my tears. Oh, oh. That splash against my hollow bones, that rocks my soul. Oh, 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 oh. Looking back over my false dreams that I once knew, wondering why my dreams never came true. Is it because I'm black? Somebody tell me, what can I do?
Welcome back. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And that was Syl Johnson with Is It Because I'm Black? Now, all right, now we're going to take a listen to a speech by Bob Avakian, a portion of a speech by Bob Avakian. It's on the role of the police.
It is doubtful that there is a young black male growing up in the U.S. today, in the South or the North, who does not have a very real fear of being brutalized or even murdered by the police. And again, this touches all black people. Another book on the history of lynching of black people in the South makes this point, and think about this. Black parents learned to fear more for some sons than for others. Those who were surly, who had attitude, who were rebellious or were careless, who had not learned the art of appearing to know their place, they were in greater danger. And tragically, parents had no choice but to try to keep their sons especially from showing those qualities like self-confidence, curiosity, ambitiousness that could be interpreted as insolence or arrogance by white people. However, this author goes on to say, there was only so much that could be done by the parents in trying to prevent disaster. Any unlucky circumstance could instantly put a black man at deadly risk. And today we see the same thing. In our party's work in the housing projects, one of the most heartrending things we've learned is how black mothers in the projects start to worry early on if the boys that they've given birth to start to show that they might grow up to be large. Because then they'll have everything come down on them that comes down on a large black male. Think of what this means, that a mother from the time her child is 2 or 3 years old has to worry that he might grow up to be too big, so he might be seen to be a threat by the police and then cut down and murdered brutally by them. What kind of a society? What kind of a system is this? Now, in this talk, I'm going to be using the words society and system a lot. By society, I mean a group of people who come together or are brought together for common aims and purposes. And in particular, I mean a society on the level of a country, where people live in a territory together and have the same government, like the United States or Brazil or Egypt or China. By system, I mean an organized way that something is held together and works. Systems have a certain order to them and certain ways in which things are done. Sometimes this is set down in formal rules and regulations or even laws, and sometimes it's just something that everybody has learned and carries out without the need for laws and people assigned to enforce them. For example, a game of cards or dominoes is a system. You have to play these games a certain way or it won't work. You can't put a domino any old place you want, any time you want, and try to think the game's going to work. What the f*** are you doing, man? And the same is true of a game of cards, or bidwist, spades, or poker. You can't just play any card you want, any time you want, or else you've broken the system and the thing won't work. The same is true of a game like basketball, which is organized in a different way than, let's say, football. You can't just take the ball and run down the court with it in basketball. You have to dribble it or pass it. And in soccer, you can't use your hands unless you're the goalie. Soccer has a different system. A song also has a system. It has certain notes and musical patterns and rhythms. And it often has certain lyrics. If you don't sing the right lyrics or sing the right tune, then you're not singing that song. Or maybe you're not singing at all. Human societies are organized into systems too. As I will get into through the course of this talk, different societies throughout history have been organized into different systems. And at this stage of human history, there is the possibility to bring into being a radically different society with a radically different system. To get another real look at what kind of society, what kind of system this is in the United States today, think about what happened to Amadou Diallo in New York. Now, Richard Pryor used to have this routine he did to show what it was like for a black man just in an ordinary encounter with the police. How you had to try to avoid being one of those mistakes where you got killed. He'd talk about a black man gets pulled over by the police and he has to say, "I am reaching into my pocket for my license. Because I don't want to be no motherfucking accident." You have to show them and make clear and loud that you're going into your pocket to bring out your wallet. Otherwise, they'll say you had a gun and shoot you down. And for Amadou Diallo, even that didn't work. Amadou Diallo pulled out his wallet and held it up, and they shot him down anyway. 41 times they shot at him. They pumped his body with bullets. Or look what happened around here to Taisha Miller. The police came up on her. She was in a car, apparently passed out. Her family came up. They begged the police because the car was locked, let them find a way to open it. But no, the police couldn't wait. They fired into the car 29 times, shooting her in the back 12 times. And that wasn't the worst of it. When the family came and was grieving, the cops started mocking them with racist taunts. "Oh, what is this, Kwanzaa? What is this, the Watts whale? This is America. This is the greatest of all countries." Well, what about what happened with Donovan Jackson and how the cops got off on that thing, too? They took him, they punched him in the face and slammed his head down on a car for no good reason and no reason at all. But they got off. One of them got acquitted completely, and the other one, oh, you know, the jury couldn't decide. But let's not blame the jury as much as the judge and the prosecutor. Whenever they're forced to put a cop on trial for brutality or murder, all of a sudden the prosecutors forget how to prosecute. Anybody who has a case, I'm sure they say, "God damn, give me that prosecutor when I got my case go up." They don't call witnesses. They don't ask the witnesses the right questions. They accept the defense theory of what happened and then argue little nitpicky things about it within that framework. The same thing happened with the Amadou Diallo case. The jury found him not guilty, and one of the jurors afterwards said, I wish we could have found him guilty. I hope they sue him, those cops, and get all kinds of money out of him. But the way the judge set it up, we had to go by the law, so we couldn't find him guilty. Well, they should have found him guilty anyway. But you know what she's saying. And the judge is part of it, too. It's part of the conspiracy. Yes, there's a conspiracy to get the cops off. Look what happened in the Rampart scandal, a scandal in L.A. They shot up this dude, Latino brother. Then they accused him of assaulting the police. He comes into court in a wheelchair. He's convicted. The judge gives him almost a maximum sentence. Why? Because he didn't show remorse. For what? He didn't do any goddamn thing. But this is the way it works. And what happened when they finally had to put these Rampart cops, or a couple of them, on trial? The judge did everything she could to get the jury not to find him guilty. But this time, the jury found him guilty anyway, so the judge threw out the verdict. Yes, there's a conspiracy to get the cops off. Or think about what happened to Alberta Spruill in her Harlem apartment recently. She was sitting there, doing nothing wrong. The cops busted in, fired a stun gun, and she died. Another accident, as Richard Pryor would put it. Another mistake. Oh, we had the wrong apartment. We were looking for drug dealers, but you're an old black woman who doesn't deal drugs. Well, guess we can't do anything about that now. And of course, they'll never be punished. In Hill Street bullshit, Richard Pryor routines and the real deal, in the book Reflections, Sketches, and Provocations, I told about the following true story that was told to me. A rookie cop had just gotten hired on. He went out on patrol with his partner, a veteran. They were driving around a neighborhood, and also, all of a sudden, a black man came running up the street. And the veteran turned to the rookie and said, go on, shoot him. It's free. What does that mean? It's free. It means here's a black man running up the street looking suspicious. You can kill him and get away with it. And that isn't even all of it. This rookie wasn't ready for that. I guess maybe he's one of those who joined up leaving all the serve and protect bullshit. So he resigned. You know why he resigned? Because he became an outcast in the police force because he wouldn't follow the logic that when you get a free chance to kill a black man, you gotta do it. This is how they are. Killing us. And they're not through. They're thrilling at what they do to us. Then they say, well, what's all the fuss? They never have to pay for murdering you or me. Is that what they mean when they say we're free?
All right, that was Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and it's an excerpt from a speech called Revolution, Why It's Necessary, Why It's Possible, and What It's All About. And you can check the entire speech out at revolutiontalk.net. Once again, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, and my engineer, Teddy Robinson. I also want to thank all of you. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. We're going to go out now with Tupac's Trap.
You know they got me trapped in this prison of seclusion. Happiness living on the streets is a delusion. Even a smooth criminal one day must get caught. Shot up or shot down with the bullet that he bought. 9 millimeter